Welcome, everybody, to the North Carolina Criminal Debrief. I'm your host, Phil Dixon, a faculty member here at the UNC School of Government. I'm joined, as always, in the studio with my friend and colleague, Paul Bonner, on the ones and twos. Big thanks to Paul. Going to jump right in. We've got some decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, and the first one I wanted to talk about was U.S. v. Himani, I think is how it's pronounced. This is arguably a significant Second Amendment case, but in some ways, as we'll see, it maybe is just as significant for marijuana policy and attitudes as it is for guns. So this came out from the U.S. Supreme Court on June 18th, and it deals with the constitutionality of 18 U.S.C. 922G3. Regular listeners or federal practitioners are aware that 922G is the general prohibitions on possession of a firearm by certain people. This one specifically, 922G3, it bars anyone who is a quote-unquote unlawful user of or quote-unquote addicted to any controlled substance from possessing a gun. This was in the news a few years back, if you recall, where I believe Hunter Biden, former President Biden's son, was prosecuted under this provision in part because he was possessing a gun at a time where he was allegedly addicted to, I think it was crack cocaine. The offense is a felony, so if you're convicted of it, you also then become permanently disqualified under 922G1 as a felon, and the penalty is up to 15 years in prison. This ban applies to any controlled substance. Out of all the prosecutions under 922G, this offense accounts for about 5% of all of those. So the vast majority of 922G prosecutions in federal court are for felon in possession. I'm sure listeners would not be shocked to know that. And a very small number of them are for being an unlawful user of controlled substance or person addicted to a controlled substance. But that is what the government brought here. The defendant was a dual U.S. and Pakistani citizen, and apparently there was some concern on the part of the federal government that Mr. Himani was involved in terrorism. I don't know the background there, but this led to his home being searched by law enforcement. They don't find any evidence of terrorism, but the defendant does, I think, volunteers that he has a gun and, hands it over. There is some marijuana on the property, and he admits to law enforcement during all of this that, I use marijuana. I use about a little bit every other day. Now, interesting side note, there was actually some cocaine there in the house as well. Not a large amount, I wouldn't say, but it was around 4 grams, which is a good little bit as far as personal use goes. And I think that would have been a much stronger case for the government to bring, where they say this person is an unlawful user of cocaine. They're regularly using cocaine. If it was I'm doing cocaine every other day, that might be a different result. But they didn't really have that here. The cocaine was found apparently in his mother's closet. He was living with at least his mom and I think other family members. His story about the cocaine was that his mother had taken it away from him, trying to keep him from using it, and that it had been several months since he had used any cocaine. At least in the Fourth Circuit, I know already under this 922G3 provision, the drug use or the addiction has to be within a relevant time period to the possession of the gun. It's not enough to say, well, you smoked pot back in college, and now as a 40-year-old person, you are still prohibited from possessing a gun as an unlawful user of controlled substances because you used them at some point in the past. At least in our circuit, and I think in many others, the rule is already that, hey, the drug use has to be relevant to the time of possession. So the government, I think, had a stronger argument here to say, well, we know he was in possession of marijuana. He admitted to regular use of marijuana, but we don't have the admission to regular use of cocaine. So the coke might have been a harder lift for the government, although it seems to me that is going through the reasoning of this decision. I think it's a lot easier to make an argument that a person is dangerous when they are regularly using cocaine as compared to marijuana. In any event, they eventually charged this guy with being an unlawful user of marijuana and possessing a gun. This defendant moves to dismiss under the Second Amendment, saying this is a violation of my rights. You know, the Second Amendment should protect this. It's just weed, in effect. The federal district court grants that motion and says, we agree. We think this prosecution violates the Second Amendment. Mr. Hamani, you are free to go. The government doesn't like that, so they appeal to the Fifth Circuit. Fifth Circuit affirms. They agreed with the district court. This violates the Second Amendment. So as a last-ditch effort, the government appeals once more to the Supreme Court of the United States and is soundly defeated. The unanimous Supreme Court rejects the government's arguments and finds the law unconstitutional, at least as applied to these facts. Just as a bit of context and review, since we had, I forget if it's Bruin v. or New York Rifle Pistol Association v. Bruin, but under Bruin, under the Bruin test, you ask first, is the conduct here that's being regulated by the law or regulation, is it covered by the Second Amendment? Does the Second Amendment protect this conduct? And here you sort of have the cleanest case of that, right? It's possession of a gun. The Second Amendment clearly protects possession of a gun. The text of the amendment covers this conduct. And so nobody was contesting that. This conduct is covered by the Second Amendment. And if that's where you find yourself, the conduct is covered by the Second Amendment, well, then it's presumptively constitutional under Bruin. It is the government's burden to come forward and justify that regulation. And they do so by showing that the regulation is consistent with our historical tradition of regulating guns. In the second big Second Amendment case after Bruin, Rahimi, the court said, you know, this historical analogous law, it doesn't have to be a perfect fit. It doesn't have to be a twin to the modern regulation, because obviously things have changed a lot. And, you know, there are weapons now that the founders could not have contemplated. But under Rahimi, you know, it need not be a twin, but it does have to be consistent, at least in principle. The court emphasized there, and they reemphasize here, the best way to determine whether it has that consistency with a founding error principle is to look at the how and the why of the law. What is the purpose of the law? How does the law achieve that purpose? Are those things more similar to some historical law? Well, if so, then it's more likely the law is constitutional and withstands a Second Amendment challenge. The less similar it is to this historical tradition or law, potentially you have a Second Amendment problem. And I'll note that there is a debate in these Second Amendment cases about what's the historical time frame we're really looking at. I think many courts are reflexively analyzing these laws from the time of the founding, like around the time that the Constitution was signed. But there is a debate, is it that time frame at the time of the actual founding of the nation, or is it at the time that the 14th Amendment was passed, which is how the rights in the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, are incorporated against the states? Court here does nothing to resolve that little puzzle. They drop a footnote and say, we realize there's a debate about that, and we're not gonna weigh in on that right now. Turning to the merit, there's a bit of a preservation argument, but this was effectively preserved, I think. And now the court turns to the merits and says, look, this law applies anytime somebody is unlawfully using any controlled substances, from the time they start till the time they stop. It doesn't matter what the controlled substance is. It doesn't matter in what amount they're using it. It doesn't matter how frequently they use it. And it doesn't matter whether that use makes a person dangerous as a user. It also doesn't matter why the person has the gun or how safely he possesses it. That's pretty broad. To justify this broad restriction on gun possession by anyone who's using a controlled substance unlawfully, the government pointed to these habitual drunkard laws from around the time of the founding. There were different types of these laws, but the court says these can historically be broken into sort of three buckets. There were laws banning vagrancy, There were laws that allowed for civil commitment of habitual drunkards, and there were surety laws. Now, surety laws were discussed in Rahimi, where a person was presenting a risk of violence. They could be required to post bond to say, you got to refrain from violence, you got to not cause any big issues. But these are different types of surety laws, which we'll get to in a second. In any event, the court rejects all of these justifications and says all of these kinds of laws are different from the 922G3 provision. There's some funny history in there. They note habitual drunkards at the time of the founding. That really meant people who drank so much that they could not manage their own affairs. This is a Gorsuch opinion writing for the court. And he notes the founders themselves were really heavy drinkers. Like, there was a culture of getting drunk among the founding fathers. One anecdote that Gorsuch pulls out is this farewell party that was given for Washington, I think, when he was leaving Philadelphia. And, you know, relatively, I think this may be familiar to any students of history, but for, I think, a relatively modest number of people, there was a bar tab that would sort of have blown your mind in terms of the number of bottles of whiskey and barrels of ale and wine and so on. And that's all listed out in this opinion. So using alcohol even to excess at the time of the founding, that was not enough to disarm somebody. It was only when that use became dangerous or presented a risk to the person's self. They said the same thing goes here. On this record, there's no indication of how much marijuana he uses. There's no indication of how strong it is. And there's no evidence that it renders him dangerous or otherwise unable to handle his business. And these things, according to the court, matter. I'm struck just sort of intuitively that's true, right? I mean, you can take a 2.5 milligram nighttime gummy, and, you know, there's probably plenty of law-abiding, otherwise law-abiding citizens who do that. And, you know, it's sort of, and it's plenty legal in many states, as the court notes at a later point. Here, under the government's interpretation, anyone who uses these illegal controlled substances are capable of being disarmed, and the court just rejects that and says, we're not going to say just because you use something that is categorized as a illegal controlled substance under federal law that you are something like these habitual drunkards that were known to the law at the time of the founding. Vagrancy laws, one of the government's purported justifications, these were aimed at people who either wouldn't or couldn't work. They couldn't take care of themselves. They couldn't take care of their family. Those laws weren't aimed at, like, dangerous people. Same with the civil commitment law. That allowed for detention of habitual drunkards. But again, this was more aimed at protecting them from themselves. Same with these surety laws. Here, they're slightly different, as I said, than the surety laws discussed in Rahimi. But basically here, they would make someone post a bond to either refrain from being drunk or refrain from blaspheming or otherwise just not being on good behavior. And here the court says the whys here is much different than this categorical ban in 922G3. And so is the how, for that matter, with all of these other things, civil commitment, vagrancy determinations, surety determinations. The person usually had some kind of process in place up front. They got some due process before their liberties were restricted. Under 922G3, this unlawful user prohibition, it's automatic. It kicks in as soon as you start using, and there's no way to overcome it. There's no due process that you're entitled to. You can't go into court and say, I'm really using this very safely, and look at how safe I am with my firearm. I'm still a responsible person. The government's interpretation would just categorically disarm these people. The court goes on to note, you know, by tying this law's reach to the Federal Controlled Substances Act and not a determination of dangerousness, it just cast too wide of a net. Anyone who misused a prescription or otherwise took some kind of drug unlawfully is arguably within its sweep. And the court notes that, hey, feds, you're kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, because there's an effort underway, and I think the process is now underway to reschedule marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule III controlled substance. And that's in recognition of the fact that marijuana has medicinal value and that it is not really that dangerous when it comes to all things controlled substance. The court observes at least 40 states, three different territories, plus the District of Columbia have some version of legal weed. Are all people who are using these substances pursuant to often state schemes, are they capable of being disarmed as a category subject to this automatic disqualification? And the court says no. Maybe a case out there, but not on this evidence. And that stance of the government that all marijuana users who are using it should be disarmed and potentially subject to felony prosecution is really inconsistent with the positions it's taking in other places and other policies. Gorsuch does emphasize this is a narrow decision. We are not taking on, one, we're only talking about the unlawful user prong of 922 G3. We're not talking about the addicted to prong. So it might be different where the government can show this person really has an addiction to a controlled substance, whatever that means. We're not talking about 922 G1. We're not talking about felons in possession. And the court says we're not even ruling out that the government potentially could have a successful 922 G3 prosecution based on someone's unlawful use of marijuana. But here, there's not enough in the record on these facts. Banning this defendant violates the Second Amendment. So remember, the district court dismissed this prosecution as a Second Amendment violation. The Fifth Circuit affirmed that decision. The Supreme Court now unanimously affirms the Fifth Circuit. There are three concurring opinions, all agreeing with the result. Justice Thomas, who is often out on a limb by himself, arguing that some kind of established jurisprudence needs to be radically reconsidered, doesn't disappoint here. He says that I agree with the result. This is unconstitutional, but he would find, and he thinks the court should reconsider the constitutionality of 922G, period, under the theory that this authority given to the federal government to come in and prosecute you for a gun actually exceeds Congress's Commerce Clause powers. And that is a legit debate among academics and commoners and people that study this stuff. Famously, and I think we've talked about it on this show, the Gonzales v. Raich case basically said even marijuana grown within a state that doesn't leave a state, that's for personal use, and that is done pursuant to state law authorizing it, well, that marijuana was capable of affecting interstate commerce, and that person could be subject to federal prosecution. That is probably the outer limit of Congress's Commerce Clause power. Thomas, and again, on his own, no one's joining him, is saying we should probably shrink the reach of that Commerce Clause power as it exists today. And maybe he's onto something there, but that is certainly not the law as it stands right now. And I think it would come as a shock to many DOJ or many U.S. attorneys for them to hear that 922G was unconstitutional writ large. Justice Jackson, joined by Justice Sotomayor, again concurs, but writes separately to say the framework put forth in Bruin was wrong. I mean, yes, we got to the right result here, but the analytical framework that I described earlier of, you know, is there a historical analog? That's just not workable. We should go back to pre-Bruin, where we applied a sort of means-ends test. What's the justification for the regulation and how much does it infringe on your rights? That, they think, would be a more workable solution for lower courts. Interesting lineup at the end. To round it out, Justice Alito writes and is joined by Justice Kagan. They said, we agree with the result, but we just write separately to emphasize we think everything else under 922G is perfectly constitutional. And here, too, in Alito's concurrence, he talks about how occasional marijuana use is not like being a habitual drunkard, and notes that the feds have allowed states to develop these now massive legal marijuana markets, and basically says marijuana use now is just as common as alcohol use was at the founding. And the government's arguments just fail altogether. I mean, a narrow decision, certainly a win for gun rights advocates, potentially a boon or some level of protection for people who are legally using marijuana pursuant to state law, but that still want to possess a firearm. Again, the court doesn't rule out the possibility that with enough marijuana use, frequently enough and strong enough doses over a period of time, or certainly becoming addicted to marijuana, still might support a prosecution under these facts. But simply saying, you know, I take a gummy every couple days or so, is probably never going to get them there. These aren't commonly prosecuted in the first place, probably because there's so many other versions of 922G, most notably felon in possession. But it's also if you're in the country unlawfully, if you're under indictment, if you've been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, if you're subject to a qualifying domestic restraining order. These really only take up a small group of those. So, but it's interesting to see, particularly from fairly conservative justices, I mean, Alito and Gorsuch are both sort of acknowledging in a published written opinion, hey, marijuana is sort of not that bad. It's different. It's just like alcohol at the time of the foundings. Our founders liked to get a little turned up, and some minor marijuana use should not disqualify you because it's become very widespread and popular in the country. And I think there's some indication that it's becoming more popular than alcohol now. Interesting Second Amendment case. I wanted to just put that on folks' radars, you know, really only relevant if you're practicing in a federal court and facing a 922G3 prosecution, but may provide some arguments as to any kind of other disqualifications that may exist under state law. I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but I would just also note the court recently decided a Batson case called Pitchford v. Kane. Batson v. Kentucky, regular practitioners will know, prohibits the use of race in jury selection. You can strike a juror for any reason with a peremptory strike, but you can't strike them just because they're of a different race. And later case law extended that to gender as well. So I can't strike a black juror just because I want an all-white jury. I can't strike a female juror just because I want an all-male jury. And this is a notoriously hard standard to meet. North Carolina practitioners are well. I think we've had maybe two Batson violations in North Carolina and I think one of those was the court saying the defendant himself violated Batson by, you know, engaging in racial discrimination through his use of peremptory strikes of potential jurors. But under Batson, the procedure is if I, the defense lawyer, the defendant, think that the prosecutor is improperly striking jurors with peremptories on the basis of race, I got to get up and say something, and I got to make a prima facie showing. That's the language of the case law. And that burden, that initial burden, is not supposed to be a high one. But sometimes you see arguments over whether the prima facie standard was met. But I think in effect, if you've got, depends on a lot of factors. I'm not an expert on Batson. My colleagues, Hannah Autry and Emily Coward over at Duke, and I think Hannah's at CDPL, the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. They are experts, and I've got a handy Batson chart from them if anybody needs sort of a trial court handout that gets in there, walks you through how to make these steps, walks you how to make on-the-fly calculations. If the defense lawyer makes this prima facie showing that the prosecutor's using a peremptory based on race, then the burden shifts to the prosecution, and they're supposed to provide a race-neutral explanation of why they struck that juror. So it's like, no, judge, I didn't strike them because of their ethnicity or race. I struck them because I didn't like their body posture, or, you know, they weren't fully honest during jury selection questioning, or I didn't like anything that's not race. And so, again, it's sort of easy for a prosecutor trained in how to handle Batson objections to come up with some kind of justification. And I think rarely, if ever, is the prosecutor going to say, yeah, I just didn't want that race of a person on my jury. And they're trained on this. I mean, it's, you see it come up in our North Carolina Batson jurisprudence, where I think after Batson came out and started getting used effectively by defense lawyers in the state, there was this famous Top Gun training for offered by the Conference of the DAs. And they basically said, here's how you get around these Batson objections. Here's all a whole number of race-neutral reasons that you can try and escape Batson scrutiny. I mean, if the prosecution successfully offers race-neutral reasons, then the burden shifts back to the defendant, and the defendant is allowed to attempt to show that those offered reasons are actually pretextual and that the prosecution really is using race as an improper factor. Just note, it has to. It's just that it's a factor. It doesn't have to be the primary or the motivating factor. If race is a factor in the use of the prosecution's peremptory strikes, in theory, violates Batson. But again, that's a really hard thing to prove. And North Carolina has been sort of surprisingly flexible in finding that no Batson violation has occurred. Many other states have many, many cases where they've found a Batson violation, but I think we've only got two where they were successful. And again, one was against the defendant. But this guy is on trial for capital murder. It's not totally clear from the facts, but it sounds like he wasn't the guy who shot and killed the person. He might have fired a gun, but it doesn't sound like he fired the fatal shot. This was a robbery gone bad, it sounds like. And he's on trial for capital murder. They're in Mississippi, and they're in a county that is 60% white, 40% black. And out of five potential jurors who are black, the DA here strikes four of them. So four out of five black potential jurors are struck. That leaves Mr. Pritchford with a 11-1 jury that is 11 white, one black. His attorney makes a Batson objection. The DA offers some race-neutral explanation, and the trial court says, Mr. Prosecutor, I'm accepting your explanations. Your Batson objection is noted for the record, defendant, but did not give him any chance to rebut. And the defendant didn't take that laying down. I think he raised it several times that, like, hey, I'm really not happy with this jury. I think it violates Batson. This guy is convicted of capital murder. The Mississippi Supreme Court upholds it on direct appeal. So he goes into federal habeas court and actually gets relief from the federal district court. But the government appeals that up, and here the Fifth Circuit reverses. So the defendant appeals all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and in a 5-4 decision, they reverse the Fifth Circuit, reinstating the grant of habeas relief. So this is an opinion by Justice Kavanaugh, basically in the language of habeas and review of state judgments in habeas court. The Mississippi Supreme Court's determination that this Batson objection was waived was unreasonable, when he didn't really get a chance to do it in the first place, and again renewed his objection several times. I thought it was notable that this is the same trial judge and the same prosecutor as the relevant players in an earlier case, I think from 2019, called Flowers v. Mississippi. That was, I think, the last major Batson case. And again, sort of same judge, same prosecutor. And the evidence in Flowers was really shocking. I mean, that guy was like on his sixth trial after repeated grants of new trials and earlier Batson violations. The prosecutor had, as I recall, just like an atrocious record that really looked bad upon scrutiny. So that's what I think the takeaway from Pitchford is the defense has to have that opportunity to rebut the prosecutor's offered reasons, and failure to give him that probably is going to result in a new trial. Shay Denning, my colleague here at the School of Government, wrote a blog or did a case summary of it that's up on the blog. I've thought for a long time, you know, just like speedy trial, our Batson jurisprudence is really sort of behind from a defense perspective in terms of how what it looks like on the ground in other jurisdictions. And I keep waiting for the perfect sort of vehicle to land up at the U.S. Supreme Court from North Carolina that would give them a chance to inform our Batson jurisprudence, because that where you have so rarely found a Batson violation is, I think, statistically significant. That's not the case here, but it's a reminder to defenders out there to really keep that Batson stuff front of mind. Like I said, reach out to me if you need the Batson cheat sheet. That gives you a good sort of guide on how to handle this stuff in court. The four dissenters were Gorsuch, Alito, Thomas, and Barrett, and their dissent really is pretty technical. Again, under ADEPA, the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, habeas relief, especially on from state court judgments, is subject to a really high bar. It's really exacting standard, and here they would have said you did not meet that standard. Close one for this defendant, but he ultimately gets his new trial, it sounds like, and hopefully perhaps a little bit more balanced of a jury in that case. Turning from the U.S. Supreme Court to the state Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court recently decided two cases that a lot of people have been waiting on that sort of we were hoping they were going to address. What's the deal with the odor of cannabis and probable cause to do warrantless searches of cars? We've covered this issue a lot on the show. The Court of Appeals has now for some time just landed on the legalization of hemp changed nothing. If a trained officer believes that he smells cannabis and thinks it's marijuana, well, that's enough, just like pre-hemp. And as we've talked about on the show before, that seems weird. And when I can walk into a store that smells like cannabis and I can walk out with legal products that look and smell just like cannabis, and they have the same effects of illegal marijuana. And presumably, you know, hemp stores are not subject to warrantless search just because of the odor of marijuana or the odor of cannabis. But we don't have that here. They took review in two cases, really three, but the third one's yet to be decided. We had State v. Rowdy and State v. Dobson. And the Supreme Court released both of these on May 22nd this year, and both are unanimous. They both emphasize that probable cause is a question of the totality of the circumstances, and they seem to say the odor of cannabis is only one factor in that totality. Both these decisions go out of their way to say we're not settling this question about whether the odor of cannabis by itself is sufficient. And that would be helpful to know, because the Court of Appeals precedent says exactly that, you know, yes, odor alone is enough. So without sort of stepping all the way through the door, these decisions cast doubt on that odor alone reasoning used by the Court of Appeals in Rowdy and some of these other cases. We talked, I think, before about Rowdy and Dobson, but just as a refresher, in Rowdy, that was it. It was the odor of suspected marijuana by trained officers who knew supposedly how to detect marijuana. A quote from the Court of Appeals decision in Rowdy: the odor of marijuana emanating from the vehicle provided probable cause, period, full stop. In Dobson, it's slightly more complicated because you had the odor of suspected marijuana plus a cover scent. Same thing. The quote from the court in Dobson was the detection by several officers of a cover scent provides a basis in addition to the odor of marijuana to support probable cause. So really, Rowdy was odor only is enough. Dobson said odor plus a cover scent was enough. And in both these cases, the court says Well, it's really a totality question, but we'll talk about just how unusual these holdings are in a second. In both cases, the Supreme Court said, we don't have to decide because there was more than that here. In Dobson, not just, you know, the odor of cannabis and a cover scent, but one of the passengers had a prior conviction for intent to distribute cocaine and marijuana. The defendant himself had pending felony charges for firing by felon and felony assault with a deadly weapon, and some earlier unnamed felony conviction. According to the court, again, the unanimous state Supreme Court, those circumstances, coupled with these highly experienced officers' suspicions of marijuana possession and cover scent during a valid speeding stop, this was probable cause under the totality. It's funny, but notably, there was a gun on the dashboard of the car in Dobson, and the officers quickly figured out that gun was legal and it belonged to the driver, who was not charged. I think she was a probation officer. That was not a part of the analysis here because they said it was a legal gun, and I want to come back to that in a second. So again, without deciding whether odor only or odor plus a cover scent was enough, this still seems like an implicit rejection of the state's arguments. They say today we hold under the federal Fourth Amendment doctrine, we continue to follow our precedents, which require examination of the totality of the circumstances to determine whether probable cause exists. In that evaluation, the odor of cannabis is one factor that can be considered. This is interesting, though, because first of all, the question granted in the petition for discretionary review to get the case reviewed by the Supreme Court was the Court of Appeals double odor holding constitutional? The court goes out of its way to say, we're not going to actually answer that question, but the totality was met here. And then they just straight up affirm the Court of Appeals. They don't modify it. They don't tweak it. They don't remand it for further anything or another. They just say affirmed. Well, that is different grounds than the Court of Appeals decision, seems to me. Again, Court of Appeals in Dobson said odor plus cover scent is enough. Court here is saying, well, you had a valid traffic stop. You had trained officers smelling something, smelling a cover scent. You had a passenger and defendant with either pending charges or records. That was enough. Turning to Rowdy, same thing seems to indicate that this per se rule that the state would like to have is not enough. They said it's a factor, but it's not enough. And same thing, we don't have to call it the odor only in Rowdy because, according to the court, there were numerous other factors. Rowdy did not immediately stop when he was blue lighted for violating traffic laws. He drove on and parked into an apartment building, only stopped there. The apartment building was known to be a high crime area and one with narcotics activity. And officers learned during the stop that the defendant had prior convictions for a drug offense and for carrying a concealed weapon. He allegedly bladed away from officers while they were trying to talk to him and stayed on the phone having a conversation with some third party while officers were trying to ask him questions. Of course, you don't have to answer their questions, but sort of behaving strangely like that, certainly I don't think officers have to ignore it. He was also frisked at some point, and officers discovered what appeared to be a marijuana blunt, a cigar emptied out and filled with marijuana. And the officer said, hey, we found your marijuana blunt. And Mr. Rowdy did not make any claim that it was hemp or otherwise contest the categorization of the thing as a marijuana blunt. So here they say all of these factors, that plus the odor, amply supplied probable cause. But here we modify the Court of Appeals decision to make it clear that the decision is now consistent with our rule that it is a totality of circumstances test for probable cause. That strikes me as a little easier to digest. They said it's not odor only. There's more than just odor here. And to the extent the Court of, without spelling it out, I mean, but the import of this affirmed as modified seems to be that, hey, Court of Appeals, this odor only thing is for the birds. It's not that simple. You need to look at the totality. But it's interesting that they did this, affirmed as modified, in Rowdy and just straight up affirmed in Dobson. It's also somewhat confusing that they didn't take on any of the other Court of Appeals decisions, or there's a earlier state Supreme Court decision, Greenwood, from the 80s, that the state likes to point to that sort of indicates that the Supreme Court, at least back then, had approved probable cause based on the odor of marijuana. But Greenwood's not mentioned in either of these cases. So you get this sort of opaque affirmed as modified in one of the two cases, and the court clearly doubling down to say probable cause is a totality question. I don't think that's a real objectionable position. But where does that leave us in terms of litigating motions to suppress and Fourth Amendment rights based on, at least in part or in whole, the odor of cannabis? It strikes me that we're like right back to 2021 and State v. Parker, where the Court of Appeals first considered this argument and there said, well, that's an interesting argument, and it sure might be a problem in the age of legal hemp, because both of these decisions also recognize, yeah, these things smell the same, they look the same. The SBI memo comes up, but we don't have to decide that question yet. If it's a totality question and there's this ambiguity around the probative value of the odor, is it odor plus then, which we saw the Court of Appeals sort of assuming without deciding for some period of time? If it's odor plus, folks, I mean, I don't think that's too reassuring from the defense perspective, because here the pluses weren't a whole lot. Arguably, the government made out their argument for Mr. Rowdy, but for Dowdy, he was stopped for a traffic violation. A passenger has pending prior conviction for a drug offense. Mr. Dobson had pending non-drug related felony charges. That's really it. None of that stuff doesn't seem to directly point to a likelihood that evidence of marijuana possession or marijuana offenses are going to be found in the car. Anybody could get stopped for a traffic violation. Anybody can have a prior conviction. Anybody can have prior charges. I don't think the cops, again, have to ignore those facts, but that's not a whole lot of substance pointing to, hey, drugs are likely to be found in this car. It's also notable, you know, again, the prior convictions thing came up in both Rowdy and Dotson, and there's no information in the record, as far as I can tell, of how old are those convictions. Under separate Court of Appeals case law, if you're taking a prior conviction into account for purposes of reasonable suspicion or probable cause, it matters how old that is. If I was convicted at 18 of possession with intent to sell and deliver marijuana, and I'm now 45, that conviction probably doesn't really add a whole lot to the equation. Whereas, you know, if it was last year, that probably gives them a little bit more. So sort of some non-decisions on this. I think if, to the extent defenders are still going to try and litigate motions to suppress, these are based on the odor only, or odor plus just a little bit. I think that's one area where you could push back on it, when the use of a prior conviction without any time reference, or the use of pending charges for which a person is presumed innocent, or the use of convictions that aren't drug convictions and don't indicate an involvement in drugs. I mean, the fact that I have a prior assault conviction, does that make it more likely that officers are going to find evidence of marijuana? You know, I think reading between the tea leaves, it's the odor of cannabis is still going to be given a whole lot of weight, and it's not going to take a whole lot more to justify a search, at least absent some negating evidence. Because remember that firearm in Dobson, there's a gun on the dash. I think that would normally get police just itching to conduct a search and get people out of the car, but they determine, hey, the gun's legal. And the court goes out of its way in Dobson to say the gun was legal, so it can't be a part of the PC calculus here. Well, what happens when there's a similar plausible claim that something is hemp? I mean, I know I've been saying it for years, I've written it, I've talked about it here on the show, but if I'm walking out of a hemp shop with a receipt saying I just purchased hemp and I have some cannabis in a package that's labeled as legal hemp, you would think that might go a long way in dispelling the officer's suspicions. So we still don't have that case. At least Rowdy was confronted with, hey, we think this is a blunt of marijuana. Well, I'm not sure I agree that it's the defendant's burden, but these cases indicate, you know, hey, if you're going to claim it's hemp and you want the court to take that seriously, now would be the time to raise that issue. When folks are not justifying it any other way, it sounds to me like officers can sort of default to assuming it's hemp. If they're not claiming it's hemp, there's no other objective circumstances indicating it is hemp, then I think the odor is still going to take you a long way. But it is good to know, and I think a positive development for the defense here, that I think you can plausibly argue against odor by itself is enough, because Rowdy in particular says we're modifying that decision of the Court of Appeals, which again said odor alone is enough, to emphasize it's a totality question. And under that totality analysis, I think that's why a hemp shop isn't subject to warrantless search, is because under the totality of circumstances, all things equal, that hemp shop is probably in compliance with the law. When we do see hemp shops raided, it's usually because they are, well, they do it for all kinds of reasons, but often there's been an undercover buy indicating that the products are hot, that they're over the legal limit for hemp, or they're suspected of criminal trademark infringement or other things, selling other illegal products. To the extent you're a legal hemp user, I think keeping your receipts out and being ready to explain would go a long way. But again, in Dobson, it's funny. I mean, they did have an explanation. They said, we just came from the club. People were smoking in the club. That's the odor that you smell. That wasn't enough. And they said, well, we smell a cover scent too. And they said, yeah, we just left the club. People are drenched in perfume and colognes and sprays and whatnot, and that's the cover scent that you're smelling. But those are a little bit more amorphous. You know, those are sort of nebulous. They said they smelled a strong odor of cover scent, strong odor of suspected marijuana. That was enough. But I think we might have a different case where somebody says, oh, no, officer, check it out. Here it is. It's hemp. It's labeled hemp. I've got a receipt from the hemp store. Call the hemp store. They can verify I was there yesterday. That may be enough to defeat probable cause. Of course, all of this may be a moot point because, you know, sort of like as we saw in the very first case, the Second Amendment case, the culture around marijuana has just changed radically in this country, really across the board, even in North Carolina, despite the fact that we still don't have any kind of legal marijuana. We do have these dual markets of there's still a strong illegal market, black market for marijuana, and a completely legal and unregulated market for hemp. I know we've talked about it on the show a lot. I don't expect that to go on forever. It's hard to predict when, you know, there would be legislative action on that scheme, but there every year, I think the legislature probably gets a little closer to at least adopting a medicinal marijuana scheme and perhaps regulating these hemp products. But the governor's office would like to see full-blown legalization of recreational marijuana, because our marijuana markets are now competing with legal markets in Virginia and 39 other states. So, you know, the times are changing. And if there were a big legislative change, then probably these Fourth Amendment issues would have to be reconsidered. I think that's about it for us, folks. I'll just note in closing that there is a third one of these probable cause odor of cannabis cases, State v. Cheyenne, I think is how it says, or Sheen. In Sheen, the analysis may be a little more nuanced because there really wasn't anything else in Sheen, as far as I recall. I think an officer said, well, I saw this car back into a parking space. And to me, that indicated they were up to something because that allowed them to leave quickly if they needed to. Well, somebody backing into a parking space, that annoys me about every day of my life when I park in a parking lot. And it's something that happens all the time. And I don't think that's a very strong factor in the probable cause analysis. But it was a high crime area. It was, a sketchy hotel that the police had familiarity with. And this is what led to the encounter between law enforcement and the defendant, where they then smelled odor. So it might be a closer case in this third companion case that has yet to be decided. We may get a little more there. I thought it was notable. These are unanimous decisions. I'm curious to see if that holds for the third one as well. It's worth noting that Dobson has filed a motion for reconsideration at the Supreme Court, you know, in part pointing out we really need an answer on this. You're ignoring the policy set by the legislature, who obviously is comfortable with legal hemp. And you didn't answer the question that you took. You know, you took up the question of, is the double odor legal? And you ducked it by saying it's totality of circumstances, but we're not going to answer that question. That's usually not how a discretionary review would work. They could just dismiss the case as improvidently granted, and review improvidently granted, but none of that happened here. But be aware, a little weirdness between Dobson being cleanly affirmed and Rowdy being affirmed as modified, but my takeaway is they're at least saying odor only ain't it, but perhaps odor plus not a whole lot does get you there. Folks, that is it for today. It's really nice to be back in the studio. Big thanks to Paul Bonner. A sad farewell to my former associate director, Monica Yelverton. She is no longer with us. She has moved on to greener pastures. We wish Monica the best of luck. Big thank you to all of you listeners, especially all you practitioners out there doing the thing in the field. Nothing but love and respect for you all. If I can help with anything, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please feel free to reach out. I always love hearing from listeners. You can reach me at dixon@sog.unc.edu. Again, that's dixon@sog.unc.edu. I'll hope to get back in the studio soon. Until then, take care, everybody.